Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, movie truthers. Welcome to this week's episode of Truth and Movies. I'm Michael Leader.
I'm David Jenkins.
And I'm Nicole Davis.
On the show this week, Oscar-winning movie magician Guillermo del Toro returns with neo-noir thriller Nightmare Alley. Kenneth Branagh looks back at childhood troubles in Belfast. And in Film Club, we're bringing Guillermo del Toro's vampiric debut Kronos back from the dead. All coming up on Truth and Movies, a Little White Lies podcast. Yes, hello listeners. It's good to be back. Happy New Year. Hope you're all doing well. Such a pleasure to be back in the host seat this week. David, how's 2022 treating you so far?
Yeah, not too bad. We've released a magazine and started on another one. I kind of came back rare. It's a weird one because I think that in the sort of movie viewing calendar of things, the you cut all the sort of January, February, maybe even March films are all those kind of award contender titles. And so like you get to see most of them at the end of 2021 or the previous year. And so it's a bit of a kind of graveyard in terms of actually being able to see new things. But Sundance starts today, for which I am not accredited, alas. But and then there's Berlin in just under a month. Lots of new, that's where the kind of new juicy stuff starts to appear. So I'm excited for that. But, we'll be covering Sundance on our website. And I'm sure, I think when Hannah comes on in a few weeks, she'll chat through some of the things she's seen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Lots of exciting stuff premiering at Sundance, and at time of recording, this is the day after Berlin announced their competition program. Lots of new films from familiar names and no doubt new discoveries within that program as well. So keep your eyes peeled on lwlies.com for coverage from those festivals. But first, we should welcome Nicole to the podcast. Nicole, it's such a pleasure to have you on. But we have to ask this question whenever we have a new guest on Truth and Movies. Nicole, who are you?
Well, where to begin? I am a freelance writer, producer, and podcaster. I have a podcast called Best Girl Grip, interviewing women behind the scenes of the British film industry about their careers and how they got them. I write for various publications at the moment. I've written for Little White Lies a couple of times, but yeah, it's always keen to do more of that. And I'm very pleased to be here, so thank you for having me.
Oh, it's an absolute pleasure. And congratulations, you had your 100th episode of Best Girl Grip this week. Who have been your highlight guests on there to sort of tease the podcast for our listeners?
Oh, that's a mean question, Michael. obviously Rose was a big deal. Rose Garnett, who is the director of BBC Film, she was my 100th guest, and that had been sort of brewing for a long time. She's, you know, a phenomenal name in the British film industry. She's done, you know, she's worked for Film 4 before moving on to BBC Film, and her hand has been in a lot of the films that we consider kind of British, contemporary British classics. So that was a highlight. The point of the podcast is to speak to people throughout the breadth of the industry, but often producers do have interesting stories. So it's producers that are often the highlights for me.
So that's a good way of selling it. Start with the latest episode and listen to every single one before that. Work your way back.
Yeah, because it gets worse.
Only sound quality gets worse, I'm sure. They're all good content, I'm sure. But the most important question, Nicole, is how is your Northern Irish accent?
Well, terrible. Actually, that's like one accent I really can't do. I could maybe venture into Australian or Welsh, but Northern Irish,
It is a hard one to do, maybe as we'll find out when we discuss Kenneth Branagh's Belfast later on in this episode. But let's kick off this week's review section with a big new release to kick off January, Nightmare Alley.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And UnitedHealthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
So before we dive into Nightmare Alley, let's kick off with a synopsis. When charismatic but down on his luck Stanton Carlyle endears himself to clairvoyant Xena and her has-been mentalist husband Pete at a travelling carnival, he crafts a golden ticket to success, using this newly acquired psychic knowledge to grift the wealthy elite of 1940s New York society. So David, I'll come to you first on this. This is a new film from Guillermo del Toro, filmmaker who's had many twists and turns in a long career. We'll talk about Kronos, his debut, later. But this is his post-Oscar film, The Shape of Water, big Oscar contender a few years ago. And he's coming back with this film. Oh, should we be excited?
Not a contender, a winner. He won it, Michael. Did you not hear?
I mean, yeah, I remember it well.
Yeah. Yeah, of course. I think, like, you know, Oscar or no Oscar, I think that for a long time, Guillermo del Toro is someone who, you know, does sort of, you know, event movies for a certain type of cinephile. You know, he's someone who is kind of working within the system, sometimes at the kind of fringes, sometimes making these kind of quite weird personal blockbusters, sometimes making kind of more personal, weird, sort of horror kind of esoterica, I think you'd call it. But yeah, I mean, he's I think the fact that he is a passionate man, he is someone who is very forthcoming in his passions and the things he likes to read, the things he likes to immerse himself in. He has this kind of, he lives in this house of collected film memorabilia from like Hollywood's classic era. And he's really just like someone who is seeped in the history and lore of Hollywood, especially kind of fantasy and those kind of like and fantasy and romance, I would say. And he's also someone who is very well versed in kind of genre literature as well, horror, sci-fi, fantasy. You know, he's got this kind of encyclopedic knowledge, really. And so it's kind of, you know, when you see a new Guillermo del Toro film, and indeed when you kind of interview him about those films, he's always kind of telling you the references and, you know, how certain scenes are kind of replicas of certain, you know, obscure noir movies or a obscure horror character. And like, yeah. And he'll say in it, in the terms he will say, it's like, oh yeah, we ripped that off from this and we ripped that off from that. So he's very kind of open about his kind of cut and paste tendencies. this is the first time he's actually taken a... This is I guess it's a remake in the sense that this film has been made before. In 1947, Edmund Goulding and with Tyrone Power in the lead. A really great film, which is... It's always worrying when the original is really great, because you're like, the question always begs itself, you know, if it's so great, do we need another one? Which I guess is the question you've got to ask with this when you're watching it. And I think that this new version and what he's done with it and the way he has kind of executed it and style, and particularly the way he's kind of lavishly stylized it, I think completely justifies its creation. And it's a really fascinating throwback to sort of Hollywood noir. And I think the interesting thing about it, and the thing that makes it maybe quite unique in the modern film landscape, is that it's not a pastiche. So much kind of noir, but when we say noir, we mean kind of detective movies, gangster movies, you know, shadows, femme fatales, all that kind of stuff. When we see that process now, it's often with quote marks around it and as pastiche. But what he's done with this film is actually make something that is kind of in the spirit of those films, down to a kind of darkness, which is quite kind of antithetical to a lot of the films you see released by major studios. So, you know, there's definitely a sense with this movie that there was, you know, he had a sense of freedom to do what he wanted to do and to have it kind of play out the way he wanted it to play out, and I think that the way he thinks it needed to play out. So
how would you characterize this film if we're approaching it? You know, he's been this filmmaker, as you said, who sometimes makes these personal films, often returning to the Spanish language, Devil's Backbone, Pan's Labyrinth, but still with that with the visionary point of view of it as a filmmaker. But then he sometimes makes these studio films, the Hellboy movies, Pacific Rim. Where does this land on that spectrum
for you? Well, it's kind of a bit of a... It's sort of in two halves of the Venn diagram, really, because on one side you have got this kind of triple A-list cast: Bradley Cooper, Cate Blanchett, Rooney Mara, Toni Collette, David Strathairn. Like, you know, it's a real kind of who's who of kind of Hollywood awards faves, all kind of lined up in a row. And but actually the story itself is so kind of strange, and it's kind of... the ideas that it's kind of exploring are so esoteric that it's kind of, you know, it sees Bradley Cooper as a kind of down at heel transient who kind of wanders into a carnival and gets a job there, you know, like all great stories, you know, gets a peek behind the curtain at the carny and realizes that not is all it seems. And he's kind of... there is this element of kind of unpicking the illusions behind the carny. And I think that, like, I think there's that he then goes on to basically develop these aspirations, which means that he kind of is going to go beyond this kind of small fry world of the traveling carnival and be a big shot on the kind of psychic circuit, and he kind of develops the... you know, in kind of sort of slightly strange, nefarious ways, develops the skills to become a sort of psychic medium and is kind of wowing the ballrooms of the big cities and making money. But doesn't, you know, he is someone who is kind of... one of his character traits is he never seems fulfilled or satisfied. He always has a kind of aspiration, and that's kind of keying into this idea of like noir being a kind of critique of capitalism and this kind of idea that you're kind of... you have these usually men who are trying to get, you know, always kind of seeking something bigger, better, but ending up with their own kind of downfall in the end. I think last thing I'll say before I pass on, because I'm blathering, but like one of the things I really liked about this film and that I find really interesting and worthy of like maybe a bit more discussion is this feeling of like I feel that it's quite an autobiographical film. I feel that like a lot of the things that in the film are about... I mean, to me, I sort of read it as a kind of portrait of an artist, someone who maybe, you know, is an artist but is too busy kind of pinching ideas off of other people to kind of really strive and succeed down to his own original thought. There's a brilliant scene in the film where Rooney Mara's character, who is a kind of, she sort of channels electricity into her body. Stanton Carlisle kind of sees her act and he comes up with all these ideas of how to kind of make it better and more dramatic and more interesting to the audience, and essentially kind of make more, you know, make it more of a show. And it's a really fascinating, like, insight into kind of, okay, this is kind of what cinema is in a way. It's kind of creating this kind of illusion just by placing things, making people see stuff and look a certain way and feel a certain way, and it's, you know, you are tricking them at the end of the day. So there's something quite kind of autobiographical, cinematic about the film and about, like, you know, what it means to make movies.
That's a really interesting thread to explore as well. In the film, he learns the tricks of the trade to become this psychic, but all the way through there's this repeating motif about not doing the spooky stuff, not going too dark and really conning people with pretending to be able to bring people back from the dead or anything like that. And I wonder how that works within that analogy, David, but maybe we can come back to that in a second. Nicole, what did you make of Nightmare Alley? Are you a fan of noirs, a fan of Del Toro?
I'm a big fan of noir. I'm a fair weather fan of Del Toro. It's funny that David brought up this kind of Venn diagram image, because to me it feels very much like a film of two halves, both structurally and tonally. You know, it's sort of, the first half is set at the carnival and that feels very much like a kind of Guillermo's playground, and you have a lot of this kind of carnivalesque and grotesque imagery, the pickled baby, and the kind of opening shot of, like, the man decapitating a chicken with his mouth, which, yeah, feels like familiar territory and full of lots of kind of weird and wonderful imagery. And then the second half sort of moves in, as David said, into the city, and it feels much more like straight drama or straight thriller, which didn't always appeal to me as much. But then, strangely, I preferred Bradley Cooper's performance in that half of the film. I didn't quite buy him as this drifting kid, I guess. Willem Dafoe keeps calling him kid, and he's like a, you know, in his 40s. He's a grown adult, and that felt slightly jarring. But there's lots to like from both. You know, one didn't kind of let the other side down, I think. It was really amazing to kind of see him doing the sort of straight thriller, and the dialogue becomes much less pulpy, and it really pulls you in. And I know we're not allowed to spoil endings, but it's a long film and you can feel at some points that it's dragging. But the kind of final act, particularly with Richard Jenkins, who I think gives a phenomenal performance, you're really kind of on the edge of your seat for kind of the last half an hour of the film. So yeah, I really did enjoy it, actually, I have to say.
It is interesting. It's 2.5 hours, just over 2.5 hours in length, and that's superhero movie length standard now, or Bond movie length. But it really does take its time in the first hour or so building a world and introducing you to all these characters, so that when it does move on from the world of the traveling circus to the higher society, you do miss some characters, you do form relationships with some of those actors. And it's quite funny, it's always the post-Oscar film. You have that big breakout success, and then you can take your pick, as you say, David, from all of the familiar Hollywood royalty. And it really is, every actor in this film has been nominated for an Oscar or won an Oscar within the last 5 years. So it is a roll call of that, but they're all used supremely well. Richard Jenkins is a latecomer, definitely, but I thought Toni Collette was fabulous, Willem Dafoe as well. Bradley Cooper, after seeing him in such a big cameo, big in terms of performance, cameo role in Licorice Pizza only a week or two ago, seeing him carry a whole movie was an interesting, going back to him being a leading man rather than as he's now a filmmaker or a bit player, was interesting. David, any standout performances for you within that stuffed cast?
I'd probably say that I liked Cate Blanchett. I thought that there was some good chemistry there, and I really thought the scenes that they did together, that her and Bradley did Cooper did together were really good. Very rare in a Guillermo del Toro film to have such a lengthy dialogue exchange. And he doesn't tend to do that kind of stuff. He's more of a kind of dynamo, wants to have the camera swishing about. But this is like, it was quite weird to see like a kind of shot, reverse shot go on for like what felt like maybe 5, 6, 7 minutes. And it was an amazingly written sort of altercation. I feel like maybe I've seen that role before, like her do that role before, which is my only, I mean, it definitely felt like a kind of evil Carol, maybe. what if Carol went evil? But like, still not very entertaining. I mean, one of the things that I think I probably would add to sort of maybe temper my initial praise is that I would probably have to say that I do think it's, yeah, that, I mean, the 47 film is like 90 minutes and it kind of does everything and maybe even does a bit more in like an hour less. So you kind of like, you know, what you do have to sort of ask what's with all the kind of bulk. And I think that true noir rarely is rarely more than like they're kind of, you know, 71 minutes. That's how you know a noir movie, because it's like 71 minutes or something. But like there are some additions. I think I don't want to maybe go into them because I think it kind of gets into spoiler territory. But there are basically like I think to justify doing another version of this and you know they've obviously gone back to the book and but there are some, I think that like at the end of the day, Guillermo del Toro is quite a kind of moral director, and him operating in this very kind of morally shady, ambiguous world of noir, I think there's maybe a little bit of tension there, and that he's had to kind of slightly change a few of the characters to make them like fit into a world that is a bit more kind of morally clear cut. Which I think is maybe something that will make sense when people see the film. But I think one of the things I really liked about the original is that even the character of Stanton Carlyle in the 47 film, there is something even more kind of weirdly slippery and ambiguous about him, and you know, he anti-heroic as well. I think that in this film you maybe feel that like the Bradley Cooper, Stanton Carlyle is, you know, maybe erring more towards the bad guy territory or the kind of morally corrupted territory. Whereas like in the 47 film, you don't really get, you know, the film really keeps it on a knife edge. It's just, you do not know what to think about this guy and whether he deserves what happens to him. And, you know, it's for me, maybe a bit more of an interesting take on the source material, but not to say that I didn't enjoy all the kind of lavishness and, you know, you feel with Guillermo del Toro that like, you know, he's not on the pinch. Every dime is on the screen.
Mm-hmm. And as we said when we reviewed French Dispatch on this podcast a few months ago, it felt, you know, like Wes Anderson was destined to make museum pieces and exhibitions, and that is exactly what Guillermo del Toro did. He turned his collection into a traveling exhibition of all of the curiosities he has in his house, as you mentioned earlier, David, and that's what his films are, and that's how I enjoy them, is the elements of design, the gizmos, the gore, and there is gore in this film that can be quite shocking, actually, surprising for a Guillermo del Toro film. You know it's coming, someone's going to get something stuck in their face at some point. But maybe within this genre trappings, you're not expecting it so much. But I do find that intriguing, David. Maybe we can come back to it another day or see what listeners think about how much this could be a rumination on filmmaking, the fantastique, the dream weavers of cinema, and the relationship with the audience. That's quite fascinating. But let's put some scores on Nightmare Alley before we move on to the next movie. David, I'll come to you first. This is out of 5, in anticipation, enjoyment in retrospect.
I'm a big booster for Guillermo. I think even when he sort of slightly misses, I think his films are very kind of like, you know, I'd much rather watch a kind of Guillermo almost miss than some other lesser director's big hit. So like probably a 5 for me. And then maybe like I'd maybe like 4s. It's not a 5-star film for me. It's got like some issues there, but still like I think there's like enough meat there to chew on.
Nicole, what do you give it?
I think anticipation 4, because the starry cast, the fact that you've got Bradley Cooper, Kate Blanchett, Rooney Mara, the setting and the plot sounds incredibly intriguing. I would then probably go 4 and 3, I think, for in terms of final enjoyment. It felt to me a little bit LA Confidential meets Water for Elephants at times, and one of those films to me is a masterpiece, and the other one is can be a bit bland. And there were moments of real peak excitement and moments where it fell in the kind of water trough.
That's
so to
cold.
Speak. So
cold, yeah. Cold.
at least you didn't say Tim Burton's Dumbo. But thank you for your scores, David and Nicole. I'd probably say 5-4-4 from me for this as well, David. I'm very much in the bag for Guillermo. Always takes something from his films, even if they're near misses. But listeners, what do you make of Nightmare Alley? Let us know if you see it this weekend at the usual channels, at LW Lies on Twitter, truthandmovies at tcolondon.com via email. But next we have another new release, Kenneth Branagh's Belfast. Set in late 60s Northern Ireland, Belfast centres around Buddy, a young boy on the cusp of adolescence whose life is filled with familiar love, childhood hijinks and a blossoming romance. Yet, with his beloved hometown caught up in increasing turmoil, his family faces a momentous choice. Hope the conflict will pass, or leave everything they know behind for a new life. So, Nicole, Kenneth Branagh, what a career he's had as actor and director. We've mentioned Del Toro has had some twists and turns. Branagh's had some peaks and troughs, but more recently known as making sort of tea time blockbuster fare with something like Murder on the Orient Express, Cinderella and Artemis Fowl, which some of us didn't, maybe some of us watched on Disney Plus when that finally came out. Now he's making Belfast, black and white, lower budget, perhaps more of a personal tapestry, maybe. How does that all fit in?
Yeah, I mean, I came to it with reservations, I have to say, because it is Kenneth Branagh, and the films that you mentioned, Cinderella, Thor, Jack Ryan, they're all undeniably entertaining, but they're not enlivening or game-changing. And I sort of thought, okay, maybe I'll give him the benefit of the doubt with Belfast, because it is a personal story and he's telling it from the perspective of lived experience. But I can't say that it changed my mind in terms of, the fact that I think of him as, a safe middle of the road pair of hands who's capable. He's not capable of making much more than kind of well-intended but watchable films. One of my main beefs was actually the child performance, which I'm hesitant to say because I don't want to criticise a child, but I think this comes down to the directing more than the acting. You know, it's the director who is going to elicit that kind of tender performance, and unfortunately we've been spoiled in that arena quite recently with Celine Sciamma's Petit Maman, films like Summer 1993 and Custody come to mind in that level of naturalness and effortlessness. But here, it feels like in every aspect of the film, the dial is turned up to sort of wrench our hearts, and that grated with me. You know, his face is always just trying to do that a little bit too much. I'm talking about Jude Hill, who plays Buddy, the kind of kid that I guess is meant to be Kenneth, because he grew up in Belfast and left for Reading when he was about 9. And obviously the black and white is troubling, in that it has been done to potent effect. But obviously Roma comes to mind, Paul Akowski's Ida and Cold War are reasons where there's an intentionality to it and there's a real reason and beauty to it. And here it feels like Branagh has maybe chosen it because he thinks it's going to elevate it to classic status without really warranting it. I didn't get much from it being black and white. And I just, unfortunately, I wasn't moved by it and I failed to connect with it. It looks quite pretty, but I would have to, it'd be interesting to see what people from Belfast who experienced the Troubles think of it, because you look back at films about the Troubles and yes, they're all quite bleak and quite nasty in some respects, so you can perhaps understand that, you know, Branagh wants to bring an element of joy and nostalgia to his childhood, because that is something that is lacking within this kind of realm of filmmaking, and yet it feels a bit too sugary and a bit too saccharine, and unfortunately, yeah, that doesn't work for me.
It's really fascinating. I find him a really intriguing personality, filmmaker, actor, coming onto the scene in the late 80s, directing and starring in Shakespeare adaptations, trying the Hollywood game, you know, both in front of and behind the camera, having a few wobbles along the way, and then, yes, as you said, directing films like Thor, which are key components of the last 20 years of blockbuster cinema, but still doesn't really build that into a solid gold career. Seems to be in a good position with the Agatha Christie adaptations. I think that, you know, that's going to do him well for a few years, even with a ridiculous mustache. But then he clearly just thought, I can do something personal. He very clearly saw Roma and thought, I could do something like that. But doesn't have the ability to strip back or focus maybe his perspective as a director. You made me think of great films of the British independent or art house circuit, films by Terence Davis and people like that, who are able to shape period dramas that play with nostalgia but have some elements of, you know, hindsight within that. And yes, as you say, Nicole, it comes off a bit sugary, but who, looking at the reviews, the advance reviews of this, people have been homing in on a few of the performances. Jamie Dornan in particular, you know, we recognise him from films and from Celebrity Gogglebox. How is he in this as the dad?
How is he as the dad? He's okay. Again, I found it all like very middling. We spoke slightly before about accents. I thought Judi Dench was great. She was the highlight, accents aside. Again, everyone feels quite one note and quite cartoonish, particularly Colin Morgan as this kind of antagonistic character. And I felt the same way about the mother and father, Jamie Dornan and Catriona Balfe. They're not given much to do beyond the sort of the anger or the emotions that they're feeling. I don't feel like there's an arc. And you could argue that that's because there's the child perspective coming into play, in that it's kind of solely focused on Buddy, and perhaps, you know, he can't fully comprehend the kind of spectrum of emotions that his parents are going through. But whereas there's a Belgian film that came out or is coming out this year called Playground by Laura Wandel, and that is very fixed in the child's perspective. This doesn't quite commit to either or of those. It just feels like it doesn't commit to anything. I found myself wondering, does Branagh even have a perspective? It's his own childhood, but I just don't know what he's trying to say with this film. And unfortunately, that vanilla-ness comes through with the performances. You just imagine that he doesn't know how to... I mean, he's an actor, he must. But to me, it just felt like he's not eliciting the best from his actors. You know, we've seen them do better in other films. I've seen better films about the Troubles, and I've seen better films about families.
David, what did you make of Belfast and Branagh?
Well. I will say, listening to what you guys just said, I think you're being very, very kind to Kenneth Branagh, director. I think he's absolutely awful as a director. I mean, I don't think his films are like, as a kind of contrast to someone like Guillermo del Toro's, he makes anonymous content. And, you know, he doesn't try and put any kind of personal stamp. He is like pure journeyman. There is nothing distinctive or personal about the films he makes. And the irony being that he's made this highly personal film that doesn't feel distinctive or personal in any way. I was really down on this film. I agree that I think there were sort of, you know, the number of kind of more interesting, more sincere and, you know, more successful kind of iterations of this story or this kind of type of sort of personal remembrance on film exist in sort of tens, if not hundreds. It's just, it, for me, I think that the ultimate issue with it is that, you know, I get when someone makes like an Artemis Fowl or, you know, a kind of Tea Time Agatha Christie adaptation, and it feels a bit shonky and it feels sort of like, you know, we're doing this very much by the numbers. I do not understand that someone would go and make this personal film, this kind of rip from the heart childhood remembrance with these kind of political trappings, and it feels so utterly dashed off. I mean, I think the black and white at most sort of prettifies it, but like, as you say, there's no kind of obvious reason for it, apart from like, you know, signposting that we are in the past. It's so much about it felt like, I don't know if it was COVID, I don't know if it was the situation, if he's like, you know, if he's under some kind of deal where it's like, okay, if you do X, Y, and Z for us, we'll chuck a bit of a side pot so you can make your little personal film, but you can only have like 2 weeks to do it or something. It felt so rushed. The sort of the shot decisions, the coverage, the camera moves, the choreography, the dialogue scenes, just nothing felt like it had been done beyond it. It all felt like it felt like a one take movie. It felt like a kind of Clint Eastwood movie, but like, you forgive Clint Eastwood because his stories are actually so interesting, and there is such a kind of like personal morality at play. Whereas this, with Kenneth Branagh, you have the terrible slipshod production and none of that kind of, you know, sense of, okay, this is the kind of thing that we're supposed to think about and consider and take away from this film. Yeah, I mean, yeah, accent work all over the shop. Talk about like, you know, something that could so easily help people suspend disbelief is just creating this very, very like that fine patina of authenticity. And I don't think he even does that. Everything about it felt so, I think that, you know, talking about a film like Roma, the reason why it's so great is because the amount of work that Cuarón and his team put into like this sense of, it has to feel authentic. We have to transport people in the past. They have to believe it. We have to go beyond what we think is enough to actually kind of create that sense of full immersion. And, you know, Branagh missed that memo and then some. You know, it all feels like kind of, there were points where it felt like card, like when they're kind of, there's a sequence where a supermarket is bombed and it feels like a kind of, you know, it feels like a set. It feels like a supermarket that's been hashed together in an afternoon kind of thing.
And this is why there is that something so intriguing about it, as somebody who has watched a lot of Kenneth Branagh films over the years. This was his attempt. This was his chance to step up to the plate and show us what was there. He's lived that life. This could be his personal story. This could be his independent project, free of the Fat Cats, Disney and Marvel.
What's happened here is like, I think that he's maybe been like, you know, he has drank too much of the Kool-Aid. You know, he has been sort of tainted by all these kind of like, you know, producers meeting, and he's been noted to death on all these big Marvel blockbusters of like, the audience gotta feel this, and we've got to get the emotion here, and we've got to have like 14% more love in this scene. And you know, it feels like he's applying that very kind of algorithmic type of filmmaking that you maybe would apply to blockbusters to this personal project. It feels like he's like, wants both. I've got to do something that's personal, but I can't forget my audience. I can't deliver to them in this kind of, you know, satisfying way that I've learned how to do in the Big House. So, yeah, just failed for me on many levels.
having said all that, though, I mean, his films can be crowd pleasers with certain demographics, and this film has been getting 5-star reviews from certain quarters. Yeah,
fair play to him.
Listeners, when
fair
you...
Play to everyone.
Fair play to him. And listeners, when you come around to watching Belfast, we'd love to know what you made of it. But let's put our scores on this first. Nicole, I'll come to you first?
I think I'm going to go twos across the board. You know, I didn't have high expectations and it didn't exceed them.
And David?
I'd probably go same as well. As ranty as I was just then, I don't think it's like... I think it's one of those situations where like a two is maybe worse than a one. You know, the two is the kind of like apathetic, just a kind of a failure, but not a kind of offensive failure. I'd actually prefer it if it was a one and was properly kind of contentiously offensive. But like, no, it's not. It doesn't even deserve the one for me.
Yeah, two's across the board from me too. But listeners, that is Belfast. Let us know at LWLies, truthandmovies@tcolondon.com or via email if you see either Belfast or Nightmare Alley this weekend, or if you go and see something else that we didn't cover, let us know what you make of your cinema-going experiences. Up next, though, we're going back to the mid-1990s for Guillermo del Toro's first film, Cronos. Here is the synopsis of Cronos. An antique dealer and his granddaughter discover a mysterious scarab-like object at the base of an old statue previously owned by a 16th century alchemist who sought eternal life. They and many others are drawn to its power, only available in exchange for blood. So this is the first Del Toro film, premiered at Critics Week at Cannes. It received quite a bit of acclaim there and had released in the UK afterwards. David, did you get to see this on release or did you come to it later?
No, I came to it later after seeing, would have been one of his earlier ones, like Devil's Backbone, I think. Yeah, Devil's Backbone was quite a big deal. And I think that people sort of went back after that one. Yeah, definitely post, whatever it was, post Mimic. I didn't see Mimic, which was his kind of thing he did after and was mangled by the studios. Yeah, I mean, what an amazing thing! You know, I had a wonderful time revisiting the film. It's for a debut feature, kind of incredible that he managed to sort of pull the resources together to make it in what was clearly a quite sort of expansive and detailed vision. It seems like he got so much of what he wanted up on the screen, probably against, I mean, he's talked, you know, we can't go into it now, but he has talked at massive length about the, you know, making Cronos, you know, how he almost kind of led him to kind of give up filmmaking because it was such a huge effort to actually get the film made. I think it was shot over quite a long period and, you know, getting the budget together was a nightmare. But actually, like, in the end, this he has got this little kind of, you know, it's almost like his own little scarab keepsake that will stay alive forever and that has been sort of supplying lifeblood to him for his entire career. So, yeah, I mean, it's quite something. And I mean, I think as a film... I think it's got some of his best and some of his worst tendencies as a filmmaker. I think like there's a sense that like probably more so than any of his other films, this is a film of like there's like 20 really cool ideas and scenes that he's executed really well. He hasn't necessarily like put them together into a coherent plot. It's a very sort of strange plot about a kind of evil uncle and his nephew who wants to inherit this weird factory. there's not a lot of like the character motivation is lacking in the film, which makes it a bit, I think a little bit hard to kind of engage with beyond a kind of superficial level. But like, I think it's a real treat. I mean, I had a really enjoyable time watching it again.
Yeah. I was in heaven rewatching this. As we said in that first segment, he has that love of gizmos, of lore, of atmosphere, and an approach to genre that is closer to the French idea of the fantastique, which is a bit more romantic and subversive than necessarily like outright thrills and spills, although there is some wonderful blood in this film as well. But as you say, it's quite a whiplash coming from something like Nightmare Alley, which is 2.5 hours long, very written, it does have plot to it, and it's got Kim Morgan co-writing the screenplay on that, to something that barely has a script, it seems, and feels like Ron Perlman, another whiplash, peeling back 30 years of Ron Perlman, who's so lithe in this film, who just seems to be just like yammering away, improvising in his scenes.
Little fun fact about Ron Perlman. So this is what I got from interviewing Del Toro, is that so Ron Perlman gave Del Toro originally a copy of Nightmare Alley and said that he wanted to make it again, he'd want to be Stanton Carlyle.
Hope there's no bad blood over that. But unfortunately, it's out of print, out of circulation at the moment in the UK. And there's a Criterion Collection Blu-ray that came out a few years ago. Hopefully we'll get that, because the old DVD I've got does not stand up. This deserves a restoration. But Nicole, what did you make of Kronos?
I really enjoyed it. I had a great affection for it. And, you know, even though it is slightly underwritten and a bit incoherent in places, there is a real kind of emotional texture to it. And at the heart of the story is this kind of grandfather, like, trying to reconnect with his granddaughter, which I found, just kind of very enthralling and beautiful to watch. It kind of reminded me in some ways of The Princess Bride, in that just sort of like schlocky but entertaining kind of feel to it. You know, the makeup as the grandfather is kind of gradually deteriorating gets more and more unbelievable, but you go along with it anyway. And I think that's the magic of Guillermo, is that he pulls you into his world. And, you know, this is no different.
And in contrast to something like Belfast, you know, Guillermo del Toro's Spanish language films, they do have a really good sense of a child's perspective, and he directs children really well in Kronos del's background.
This is a weird one, because the kid doesn't talk at all in the film.
No. Yeah, she's very silent. But there's also a delicacy to it, you know, if we're comparing it to Belfast, that, you know, whereas that is sort of broad strokes in the broadest sense, this, you know, there are some really like quite sweet moments in places that you wouldn't expect them. Like a scene that stood out for me is when the grandfather, Jesus, he's kind of looking for blood, and he's in this bathroom, and he finds a puddle on the floor, and the sort of the earnestness with which he approaches this puddle of blood and kind of starts licking it is kind of like a child licking an ice cream, and I sort of was quite wowed by that.
And it's so good in the sense of it is so stripped back and barely there and slightly incoherent and plotless, but there is so much room there then for meaning to rise out of what we're seeing. So it's such a good allegory for, I don't know, drug addiction, for grief, and how we hold our you know, older and dead relatives in esteem once they've gone, and how they you know, survive in our memories or in our attics. It's really something. Would recommend listeners, if you've not watched that, go and watch Kronos. Very quickly before we wrap up, would we shout out another Del Toro film? Nicole, does one come to mind across his body of work? I know you said that you run hot and cold with his films.
I'm going to go with Crimson Peak.
That's a controversial one, right? It divided people. I'm a fan. But you're a fan then.
I'm a fan too. It speaks to me.
And David, I know that around, would it have been Crimson Peak? There was a big Guillermo del Toro retrospective issue at Little White Lies, was it? So you're well up on Guillermo.
Well,
what's the one that stands
out
for you?
I think his masterpiece is Pacific Rim. I think it's one. I think it's still for me the best blockbuster of the 21st century. I've bought an HD 4K version of it, and me and the missus are gonna watch it soon. It's a ballet movie. That's my take on it. And I think I just think it's utterly glorious. I've watched it about probably 6 or 7 times. I think it's his one perfect movie.
Oh, wonderful. I've not seen that since the cinema, so I think I'm well overdue a rewatch of that. Thank you, David. Maybe I can come round and watch it with you and the missus.
Be my guest. Bring the kids.
Well, that is our thoughts on Kronos, Belfast and Nightmare Alley. Listeners, thank you for listening. And thank you to Nicole and David for joining me. Listeners, if you want to send us your takes on the films we've talked about this week, email us truthandmovies@tcolondon.com or tweet us @LWLies. Next week, we have Pedro Almodovar's Parallel Mothers. We have Romuald Garai's debut Amulet. And in Film Club, we have a Pedro Almodovar classic as picked by you, the listeners, on Twitter. If you want to get it spoiled for you, head to LWLies on Twitter and see what won. David, Nicole, thanks again for joining me. And listeners, thank you for listening. We'll see you next time. Truth and Movies is a Little Dot Studios production for Little White Lies. The podcast is hosted by me, Michael Leader, and my guests this week were David Jenkins and Nicole Davis. Truth and Movies is produced by Jake Cunningham and is edited by Steph Watts.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.